Hello and welcome back to the Herb Doctor podcast with me, Katrina Hegarty, and Dr. Dealish Clare. I hope you're well today, Dealish. How are you doing?
Good. Yep. We both had busy days, so we're coming at this with great enthusiasm, but hoping it'll all go smoothly.
And of course, I hope you're enjoying the lovely sun that we're having at the moment and in the middle of September. And I'm sure whatever you're up to, I hope you are enjoying listening to the Herb Doctor podcast. So, Dealish, what would you like to discuss today on this podcast?
Well, we're talking about herbs to promote sweating. And you might think, when would we want to do that? And one of the times you might want to do it is when you have a fever, because they benefit the therapeutic effects of a fever. And so we'll be doing that. We'll then be talking about what the alternatives from the biomedical branch of medicine. I loved putting that together. They're the alternative.
Just say that again.
The alternative offerings from the biomedical fraternity and sorority. I'll also, you can see whether we pass the test, because I will give you the formula for our blends. And you can see, you can make these blends up yourself. We don't make any secret of it. They're available on the website. But you can see how we would go about managing an infectious condition, with diaphoretics being one of the actions. So instead of people saying, what do you take for a fever, and giving a list of herbs, you're thinking, you know, how can I promote the fever and what are the herbs that will do that? And I'll mix them with herbs with other actions that will complement each other. So it's a new way of looking at herbs. And then I will summarise the key points.
Fantastic.
Okay. So it's very practical, because everybody gets the flu. We've just come out of COVID. Seems like a bad memory. So, and especially people with children who get fevers. You might think, from all that you listen on ads on television, and I mean, it's getting to be bad here in Ireland, but any time I've been to the States, it's kind of like massive, massive selling of herbs, of drugs on commercial advertising, and whereas they're actually a lot more strict about it here. But you would swear that fever is to be avoided at all cost. You've got to suppress it, stamp it out. You've got to take these pills, and that way you'll be able to go in and do the presentation tomorrow and impress the boss and get the promotion and live the dream. Okay, guys, it ain't like that, all right? Medicine has forgotten that we need to take care of ourselves, be in a warm bed and be resting while we have a fever. And nobody should be taking an antibiotic if they're not prepared to go to bed. Okay. Because there are side effects of antibiotics. That's not what I'm dealing with today, but it's just a little rule of thumb. So, diaphoretics. Fever is not an enemy, and I'll explain why. And it is an immune response. It's a robust immune response. And it is indicated by feeling hot, chills, shivering, and a desire to be warm are the classic signs of building up a fever. And then when you've built up to the height of the fever, you feel hot and warm and usually have a rapid pulse as well. So the role of a fever in the immune response is that it will kill the pathogen. That's the virus or the bacteria or archaea or any of the other things that's involved. The immune system releases chemical messengers as part of their healthy immune response. And these travel to the brain, where we have a thermoregulatory aspect of the hypothalamus, if people like to know what it's called. And these act as the body's thermostat. So they change the thermostat. It's like with your central heating. You change the thermostat to increase the temperature within your body. The elevated temperature creates an inhospitable environment for many pathogens who can't tolerate. If you want to kill germs, you in water, you heat the water. Same thing with the blood. You heat the blood. It accelerates the activity of immune cells like white cells and T cells, white blood cells and T cells, making them more effective at fighting off infection. So two things that you really want to do to avoid ending up in hospital with an infection. You want to have the infection, get the fever, get better, and not go near a hospital. This is different from the alternative offering, which is the pharma drugs, which suppress a fever. this was brought home to me when I read an article which showed that people with a robust fever response were less likely to develop long COVID. But that's hindsight. Because at the time, we were told, it was fully embedded in us, go to bed, take either paracetamol or non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and wait to either need to call an ambulance or get better. Wow. Right? This was a unique medical response to people's serious illnesses. But moving on past that, from a herbal point of view, this was entirely predictable because you've knocked out two of the healthy immune responses. Therefore, you don't get the proper killing off and elimination, which would mean that you get a clean infection and a clean recovery. I've observed this in my 25 years of practice over and over again with people having flu. They have the flu, they take the herbs, they get very sick, but they don't have that 6 week post-flu, you know, like even ordinary post-flu response. So how do the diaphoretic herbs help? In addition to modulating the fever response, the diaphoretics move stagnation and promote the release of toxins through perspiration, making it useful for things like colds and congestion. So you're relaxing the pores so that they open up, so they release fluid. And in the fluid, you also release toxins because bacteria produce toxins in order to weaken the system and gain further access, among other things. So there's two kinds of actions from what we call diaphoretics. One is a warming diaphoretic, and this is at the beginning of fever. So you feel a bit off, you can feel you're getting a bit of chills, you're getting sore joints or whatever. I'm talking about a typical flu. And then you notice your fever is rising and then you kind of go, I've got to go to bed, right? So that's the process during the rising of the fever. And you can get to feel cold and shivery even though you're burning hot. All right. So they're going, give me more covers, more covers, more covers. And somebody puts their hand on your forehead and say, but you're burning. And they say, no, I'm cold, I'm cold. So the all of the energy from the body is trying to build up the core temperature so that it can kill off the bugs. So warming diaphoretics stimulate the central circulation, and they also dilate the peripheral blood vessels, bringing the heat that's trapped in the body's core to the surface of the skin. And this is where needed. This is why it's called modulation. So they help to more evenly distribute the heat while a fever is building. This action in the body helps it to reach its new set point, which was set by the brain, going warning, 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 put the heat up. Bugs coming in. So it helps the body to achieve that more quickly and more comfortably, because they also help with some of the symptoms of the fever, like the chills and the shivering. So they make you feel more comfortable and they aid your immune response. Then there are cooling diaphoretics. And these are for when the peak of the fever has been reached, and then there's the cooling off period. So these herbs are used once that happens, and the patient might feel hot, restless and flushed. So this is when they're throwing the blankets off, where they were going, give me more blankets. Then they're going, oh, I'm boiling, I'm burning up. So this is when you use the cooling diaphoretics. And it's used to release excess heat. So they open the pores. They facilitate the release of heat through gentle natural sweating. They have a relaxing or nervine effect that helps the body let go of the heat and also calms them down. I'm thinking of thyme in particular. Thyme is antimicrobial, diaphoretic, and it also helps with the sleep. So if you've got a chesty cough or whatever, it'll help with that part of just staying calm and sleeping better. So these help the body's thermostat to return to a normal set point gradually and effectively. They provide relief from the intense heat and can prevent the fever from becoming dangerously high. That's hence the modulating. They're not stimulators, they're modulators. All the while supporting the natural resolution of an immune response. So in summary, diaphoretic herbs are not designed to end a fever. They support the fever, the building up and the letting down of the fever's response. So, and there's a very nice reference describing this in the podcast notes. but I've said it all already, so I don't need to read it out. They're usually used either by tea infusions or tincture, and sometimes in capsules as well. And they're often used in a blend because you also want a stronger other antimicrobial herbs. You might want different herbs to do different things, pain relief being one of them, like willow bark. Okay, so the warming diaphoretics, these are things like everybody will know some of them. They'll have them in their kitchen cupboard as well. Cayenne pepper, right? A powerful stimulant that increases circulation and promotes sweating. Ginger, so fresh ginger tea. We all know the lemon and ginger. That's the reason for it. Vitamin C and a diaphoretic. Echinacea, either Echinacea purpurea or angustifolia. These would be immune modulators and also have a warming diaphoretic action. And you can see that some of these have more than one action. Yarrow. Yarrow is probably the universal go-to for a diaphoretic herb. It's known as it has both a warming and a cooling effect. And the body chooses, you know, so we have to trust the body's healing response. Depending on when it's used. It helps to raise a fever to a safe level to fight off infection. Cinnamon, Cinnamomum zeylandicum or cassia. This is a well-known spice, potent warming diaphoretic. And people often use that with turmeric as well because turmeric is an anti-inflammatory. Thyme, our own thyme, our own garlic, all right, antimicrobial. And garlic, if you want to use garlic for children, they don't eat it raw very well. You can just down one or two or three local cloves of garlic in the day, especially if you're prone to bronchitis that goes down to your chest because it's more antibacterial than antiviral. But if you want to use garlic in children, you can split a garlic clove and the glistening oily side, you can rub that into their feet and their hands. And it will give you, you know, you have enough garlic if you're breathing it out of your, in your breath, right? That's a saturation amount of garlic. Holy basil. I love holy basil for all kinds of reasons. And it's very nice if you're feeling sick. Who doesn't need a nice holy basil herb? It's also called Osimomum sancti. I'm reading out the official Latin name, botanical names, because I love them. It's a hot aromatic herb and also a diuretic. Angelica, and this is Angelica Archangelica. See? Angelica Archangelica. Who doesn't love that? And this is our own European native Angelica, and it's also good for digestive upsets. So that's very useful as well. It promotes sweating for digestive and respiratory issues. And then we have the big, big, strong one, which is horseradish.
The big guns.
The big guns, horseradish. You'll notice that most of these are pungent, aromatic, smelly. Pungent is like the wasabi, you know, for the sushi. It's that really strong, goes up the back of your nose, almost like a stingy. Yeah. So you can imagine how useful this would be. So you get a root and you chop it up and you put it in your infusion and it would make an angel cry. It would make the Angelica Archangelica cry. But boy, does it work, especially if you're prone to sinuses. If every time you get an upper respiratory tract infection or bronchitis or chest infection and you're left with this prolonged sinus post-nasal drip, horseradish, right? You can put it in your garden if you have a big garden. It does tend to go a bit wild. And you can grate it and put it in ice blocks in the freezer so that you've got some if people need it. And it's the volatile oils in garlic and in horseradish that give us these effect. I could give you the Latin name, but the chemical name, but that they're not nearly so much fun. It's actually allyl isothiocyanate. It's not nearly as nice as Armorica rusticana, is it? So there you go. And you'll feel the sensation in your nasal passages, a bit like a vindaloo curry, but the same effect, but a different action. Okay. And then you have cooling diaphoretics. So these open the pores and release heat. They're often used for fevers where the patient feels hot and dry, right? Or to help cool down during the hot weather. So these would be good for people who get heat rash. So elderflower, and I would add in elderberries, which are in season at the moment. I have them drying in my kitchen. A gentle cooling diaphoretic also used in a tea with yarrow and peppermint to treat fevers. So Yarrow, elderflower and peppermint. Flu. Yarrow, elderflower and peppermint. Then peppermint, which is Mentha piperita, known for cooling properties and ability to act as a diaphoretic. Catnip, which is Nepeta cataria. Now, catnip I mainly use instead of peppermint for children, right? So it's not quite as stimulating. So they're not climbing the walls, which you'd be very appreciative of. Chamomile, gentle, calming, digestive, mild diaphoretic properties, but really earn their keep as a gentle diaphoretic because of the restlessness, you know, especially with children, they get very restless. Linden flowers, Tilia cordata, a relaxing diaphoretic known to soothe the nervous system. And again, that's lovely for children. The lime buds and bracts in the spring, and very, very nice to drink. They're slightly sweet. And then boneset. Boneset is historically used to treat fevers, particularly those associated with the flu. It's a very bitter herb. Anything that's bitter, the yarrow. So the warming diaphoretics tend to be aromatic and pungent, and the cooling ones tend to be more on the bitter side. So we've done that. Oh, and feverfew, which is Tanacetum parthenium. And these are also used for treating migraines, but also have diaphoretic properties. Okay. So the one we might not think of is wild yam. But you, see, the way the media works, wild yam, Dioscorea villosa, is for menopause, and you don't use it for anything else. Why is it useful in menopause? We come back to thermoregulation, and why do we have flushes through the menopause? It's because it's a big transition, and the body is trying to reset via thermoregulation. It's a sensible thing for the body to do, but it's very unpleasant when you have it, and some people have it very severely. So wild yam is a cooling diaphoretic, and it's also a relaxant, which can relieve spasms and tension throughout the body. This action is extended to the skin, helping to open pores, which reduce fever and cool the body. And around the time of the menopause, a really nice combination is wild yam and chocolate tincture. That's chocolate with no dairy and no sugar. So but they work particularly well together. And it's also useful for fever, which is accompanied by a lot of muscle cramps or restlessness. So I spent a bit more time on that because it just makes another little point, which kind of extends the breadth of using herbal medicine. And the last one is Viola odorata, is cooling and moistening. People often get very dehydrated. So that's particularly good for, so I would say that's particularly good for the elderly, who often go into an infection slightly dehydrated. And then this holds, by hydrating, the Viola odorata, it's like it holds on to the moisture in the tissues. How are we doing?
Plenty of time, you're all right.
Okay. What is that? Can you follow all of that, Katrina?
I think at this stage now, I'm starting to understand a lot of what you're saying. And I do, I'm getting to the understanding that, you know, about the fever and, you know, the cooling and the, you know, and the different things that you've mentioned there that are so good. And a lot of it that I'm getting now is that there's a lot of things that you're repeating the same, like the same sort of herbs for different ailments.
Because of the actions.
Yeah.
The actions are related to the constituents.
Yes.
And then they're individualized for the individual patient. So we go on to the alternatives, and you see why I'm a herbalist. The official advice from the establishment medicine, right, which I call biopharmacy medicine, is that you take either non-steroidal anti-inflammatories or paracetamol. So the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories we'll do first, things like ibuprofen, naproxen, diclofenac, and aspirin. They can reduce the fever. They are effective. Their mechanism of action can lead to a range of unwanted effects, both common and serious. So what are they? Now, one point of this is demonstrated by an observation in the 1970s by a woman scientist. Her name eludes me. It's in my book, which will be about to come out very, very soon, but there's a whole section on it, where drug safety is never assumed, especially since it was recognised in the 1970s that aspirin causes Reye's syndrome in children. And this was a game changer. Reye's is R-E-Y-E apostrophe S. This is a rare but serious and potentially fatal condition that can affect the brain and the liver. For this reason, aspirin is not recommended for children or teenagers. It was realised that this was an integral part of breaking the spell of believing that everyday pharma products were somehow beyond scrutiny. That was only the 1970s.
What?
Yeah. Doctors had previously described these symptoms as complications of the illnesses.
Yeah.
Either the influenza or the chickenpox. What they overlooked was that aspirin was advised for the alleviation of symptoms of these illnesses in 90% of these cases. So they had the illness, they were recommended to take aspirin, and they got Reye's disease. In hindsight, they realised that 90% of the children with Reye's syndrome had taken aspirin.
Oh, right, okay.
That didn't come out of a clinical study. That came out of just counting heads, you know, and somebody going, hold on a minute, and realising this and then publishing it, right? Reye's syndrome in children was devastating for the families as it had a 20 to 40% fatality rate.
Oh my goodness.
Right? So here's the body bags. And the advice was given in all faith, in all, you know, kind of the fever is uncomfortable, we can't bear to be uncomfortable, and the children are crying, so give them this and they'll stop crying and the fever will come down. And it was only an associated thing that was noticed. So nobody was wrong, but this is what I mean by an absence of a precautionary principle. These things should be used where appropriate and not misused. So this is one of my points. So other unwanted effects of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories are gastrointestinal issues, very well known, bleeding from prostaglandins. It's one of the known anticipated toxic effects. Indigestion, nausea, vomiting, stomach pain and heartburn, and stomach ulcers and perforation. And this is from the first day of taking the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. This isn't if you take 2-3 times a day over a period of weeks. This can happen with the first dose or the fourth dose or the 10th dose, and people have the flu for 10 days, right? So from the first day of use, all non-steroidal anti-inflammatories increase the risk of gastrointestinal bleeding, myocardial infarction, and stroke.
Well,
referenced. Okay. And this is what was advised during COVID. Even after the complication of myocarditis. I have an issue with that. I really do have an issue with that. Non-steroidals have an increased risk of heart disease and stroke and raised blood pressure and fluid retention. So all we need when we're in the middle of influenza is fluid retention. Particularly dangerous for people with high blood pressure or heart failure. I don't remember anybody on the news or with any of this advice making exceptions for people with these conditions.
Mm.
You know, and if it was in the small print, I don't think a lot of patients knew either. It was just can the fever with medication. They can also cause kidney damage, allergic reactions, worsening of asthma, liver damage, and we talked about the Reye's syndrome. So the summary from the alternative biomedical side, from the official websites, in the context of fevers, non-steroidals act as a suppressive therapy. While they can provide relief from discomfort, they do so by overriding the body's natural immune response. This suppression, combined with their mechanism of action, can lead to a number of unwanted side effects, ranging from all the things we've said.
Fantastic. Unbelievable. I'm actually, you saying I'm not raised diapers, but the whole of me is shocked learning about this today.
I'm not shocked today because I learned this during COVID from, and I'll put the reference to it at the end as well, from an article written by 15 international pharmacologists, including Fabian Boylan in Trinity College Dublin. And they went through the evidence from clinical and supportive life sciences studies for, I think it was 32 herbal remedies. And they used a PROACT URL, which was a way of looking at risk and benefit over a large population. So it was a particularly useful methodology, if you like. And they included the risk benefits between the herbs and the drugs. And this was when I realized this. And I wrote a summary of the benefits, the risks and benefits, and sent it to all of the media outlets that I could think of in Ireland during the COVID times. I did not get one. I think I sent about 15 contacts, you know, like a press release and information, did all the work for them. I did not even get one email in response, not even to say that they had received it.
Not even an acknowledgement letter?
No.
Oh.
And this is why my book Uprooted Medicine, along with Tim Morrissey, it gives the reasoning behind all of this. So I'm not shocked that this is the case, but it is the case. So are we ready for paracetamol? Okay, tell other biomedicine suppressant. And it says paracetamol, the introduction is, can, like any drug, it can have unwanted effects, especially if misused. The unwanted effects are liver damage, hepatotoxicity. And the people who are more at risk of those are people with chronic alcohol use, pre-existing kidney disease, people with non-alcoholic fatty liver, which is growing massively in incidence or prevalence, malnutrition or being underweight, and taking other medications that affect liver function. So I would include polypharmacy. Now, a lot of the elderly population are on polypharmacy. Polypharmacy is three or more drugs taken, usually taken for the same or different diseases, but having different actions. And again, massive increase in the last 20 years.
We look forward to you joining us on this journey of exploration and learning with the herbal doctor, Dr. Dailish Clare. And we'll be back with you very soon. So thank you very much and stay tuned.